I join with Gary in thanking the choir for their wonderful contribution this morning, and yours as well, Gary. Thank you for those words. Several years ago, I did a sermon in which I dealt with the topic of how religion can be both a force for good and a force for ill. And in that sermon, I referred to, got a little mileage out of this book by a woman named Jessica Stern. It's called Terror in the Name of God. Ms. Stern, make that Dr. Stern, is a lecturer at Harvard, from which she also holds a PhD in public policy. She's been a highly regarded foreign policy consultant wearing a variety of hats, both in the Clinton and Bush administrations. Even prior to the publication of her book, she had established herself as an expert of global repute on terrorism and its religiously based roots. In writing her book, she was actually able to get into Pakistan. She interviewed Al-Qaeda members. In this country, she interviewed persons who bombed abortion clinics and the like. She drew connections between their fidelity to religion and their acts of violence. One thing that allowed her to do this was an uncanny ability on her part to maintain, as she even noted herself, a kind of dispassionate demeanor while talking with and being in the presence of, oh, truly some of the baddest people on the planet. And in so doing, she provided valuable information on how her mind works and how that mentality works between religious devotion on the one hand and committing acts of violence on the other. Well, just a few months ago, Dr. Stern published another book, also had the word terror in the title. It's this one. The title of that one is called Denial, a Memoir of Terror. In a way, it's also about terrorism. In this case, it's the terror she experienced in 1973 at the age of 15 at her home in Concord, Massachusetts, where she and a younger sister of 14 were very brutally sexually assaulted by an assailant who was never apprehended. The girl's mother had died when they were both quite young. Their father is a research scientist. He was in Europe when the attack happened. While the care for his daughters had been arranged, they were both alone in the house when the attack took place. While this horrible incident was not a repressed memory on Dr. Stern's part, it was one she had pushed off to the edges of her memory in a very fuzzed up way until she found herself in touch with a Concord police officer who was still trying to clear the case after 35 years. Ms. Stern still lives in Concord. The officer, as he'd examined the case in the department's cold case files, noticed that several other similar types of incidents had occurred at the same time as that of young Ms. Stern's, and he didn't just want to let it go all that time. The case, however, remains unsolved. But in meeting with the officer, whom she'd actually known when they were both students in high school, in Concord, same high school, Jessica Stern found herself being taken back to the act that had been perpetrated upon her and to a recognition that she'd never fully come to terms with its effect. And she describes that journey, she describes that experience in this book I just mentioned, Denial, a Memoir of Terror. In addition to telling her own story in here, she writes about others who have had to deal with a variety of types of post-traumatic stress disorder following traumatizing experiences of their own. Everything from soldiers returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan to persons abused by priests and other clergy and other similar type situations. Well, I've not read this book all the way through. What I have read is kind of amazing and quite moving, but it's not something I'm devoting an entire sermon to this morning. One thing that comes through that I was particularly struck with, though, is Dr. Stern's recognition that with the help of the brilliantly analytical mind with which she was blessed and which she was able to cultivate all the way to a doctorate from Harvard, in doing that, she was also able to intellectually distance herself from the personal terror she had experienced as a 15-year-old by becoming an internationally recognized expert on the nature of terrorism itself. Now, that in no way takes anything away from the value of her work. That work stands on its very own fine merit. But it does offer a certain perspective. She came to see, in the course of telling her own story, she came to see that she was able to be as dispassionate and in some ways emotionally detached as she was in her conversations with some really violent people. She came to see she was able to do that because she was had emotionally detached herself from the pain and the violence that had been done her before she reached full adulthood. She came over time, she had to come over time, shut down a good deal of her emotional feeling side to the point that she did not even feel fright in ways that are, by her own acknowledgement, not healthy. So in a certain sense, both of her books are about the same subject. They draw on the same narrative, even while being written from two radically different standpoints. One standpoint is a dispassionate, though hardly non-judgmental, treatment of those who inflict violence upon innocent persons. The other is about the violence that was inflicted upon her. It is the same life with the same theme, just coming from two very different angles. Well, I realize this is a pretty heavy duty, maybe even a heavy-handed way of getting into a topic like the narrative of your life. But as deeply sobering and painful as I know the content of this illustration is, it gets at a larger point I'd like to shed some light on today. And that point is that our lives are not simply a series of events that just willy-nilly happen. Some very good and happy ones, some terrible ones, most of them somewhere in between. It's not just a random series of events. These lives are also parts, they are components of a greater narrative, a greater story that we are constantly telling, in one way or another, however consciously aware of it or not we are. Well, even though her first book has considerable religious content to it, I doubt that Dr. Stern regarded her writing either of her books to be a particularly religious exercise. Her religious roots are in Judaism. How much of a practitioner she is, she doesn't say, or I've missed her, not caught up to it. But consider what I have said up to this point. In light of some words by a lay theologian and political pundit, sometime political pundit, Michael Novak, in a book he published over 40 years ago, titled Ascent of the Mountain, Flight of the Dove. The book is long out of print, but it remains one of my more personally meaningful and helpful scriptures. I've got a set of books I consider my personal scripture, and this happens to be one of them. I know I've used it in other sermons, but try this quote out from Michael Novak. Religion, some think, is believing in doctrines, belonging to an organization, saving one's soul through an attitude like trusting God or works. But there are countless ways of living out the same doctrines, many different ways of belonging, an endless number of ways of misperceiving one's own soul. That is why it seems better to imagine religion as the telling of a story with one's life. Each person's life does tell a story. Often the stories meander and seem to have no single set of threads, have seen no single thread or set of threads. Novak continues. But even dispersal is a story, and an astute novelist might untangle its many threads. To trace the history of acts of will, the history of choices made, even those made by not choosing, is to trace a voyage, a pilgrimage, a search, and a labyrinth. Well, yes, we all tell a story with our lives. And Novak is probably right when he says the stories often meander, and he's right when he says the threads can very easily get tangled. I would have to take issue with him. In fact, I would quite disagree with him on it, largely on the basis of some writing workshops I've taken over the past few years. I would have to disagree with him when he says that one has to be an astute novelist in order to untangle those threads. Now you really don't. All it really takes is some willingness to engage in some deliberative reflection and perhaps do a little writing about it as you are moved to do so. But why even use terms like religion and religious in describing this process in the way that Novak does? Well, it goes back, as I see it, to the root meaning of the term itself, one I know I have spoken to in other sermons. So don't stop me if you've heard this one before. Indulge me instead if you've heard this one before. If we break the word religion out into two component parts, throw in a little Latin, you get the term re, R-E hyphen ligare, L-I-G-A-R-E, which literally means to bind together, to bind back. The terms religion and ligament have the same origin, and each in their own way, they do the same thing. Roughly translated, they both come out as that which holds it all together. And it is this understanding of religion that Novak is drawing on when he says that religion is the telling of a story with one's life. It is the pursuit of what it is that finally, ultimately, and maybe even in some cosmic way, binds your life together. So what I want to move to now is to cite maybe just a couple of guideposts in getting at one's narrative, should you decide to undertake that for yourself. And I'm going to pick up on that line from Novak where he writes about tracing, as he calls it, the history of acts of the will, the history of choices made. And I'm going to give that a little bit of a twist to say that the recovery of your narrative, the recovery of one's narrative, involves tracing the history of the life that chose you, as well as the life you chose. You can't do one without the other. The late poet, troubadour, UU minister, personal friend of mine, Rip Masson, whose story I was privileged to get into a book before he passed away a couple of years, speaks to this. Now, Rick's best-known song, poem, we all know that. It's Let It Be a Dance. It's in our hymnal. We sing it all kinds of times. Another of the myriad, lifelong myriad of Rick's poems, is one he wrote called Master of Ceremonies. It's one I'm intrigued with, even as I wrestle with it. Now, in the poem, his specific Master of Ceremonies reference is to the role that he plays as officiant in the many, many weddings that he performed in California's Big Sur country. One of which I was privileged to attend as I was doing my research about it. But in a larger sense, the title of the book, the title of the poem, Master of Ceremonies, he's also raising the question of how much or not we are the master of ceremonies in our own life. Here's some of the poem. I refuse to believe in personal free choice. It feels like I have it. But when I back away from something I've chosen, it always turns out that the choice I made was based on something I didn't choose. I arrive predetermined. Gifts and talents, DNA, IQ, disposition, all of which begat the artist, that begat the actor playwright, that begat the troubadour, that begat the poet, that begat the minister, adding up to the master of ceremonies I am now. I ask myself, how lucky can you be? Able to make a good livelihood by assisting the creation of unforgettable moments for audience and congregation, but most of all for the couples I danced with on the beaches and rocky promontories that graced the Big Sur country. He concludes the poem with these lines. For someone who doesn't believe my choices are free, I rejoice in the life that has chosen me. Well, I had a chance to discuss this poem with Rick, and in our conversations about it, he acknowledged the irony, he acknowledged the paradox of calling himself a master in a poem in which he also acknowledges all that chose him rather than what he chose. The poem itself, in a very compressed way, as you may have picked up, is Rick's personal narrative, what with all those begats in there. And even as he points to the dynamic, he points to the interplay that is found as we discover what chose us and then what choices we made in the face of that. And on this note, I'm going to take these thoughts in a somewhat more personal direction. I believe I did say in my newsletter blurb for this Sunday I'd be referring to a writing project of my own along this line, so I guess for the sake of truth and advertising, if nothing else, we'll go there for a bit. As I mentioned earlier, much of my impetus for this sermon comes from a writing workshop I took a couple of summers ago and followed up with a second installment this past summer, the same instructor both times. In those things, much of the focus was on what the leader called spiritual autobiography. And when I got through the first round of this, it was like pretty intense. You did 5 days, about 4 hours a day, just five straight days and four hours a day. And when I got back from that, I took a look at all the notes I'd taken, and I realized that about three-fourths of the time I had been writing about summers I spent on my grandfather's farm in southern Ohio from the time I was about 4 or 5 years old until I was in my early teens. And so in the months that followed, as it got into winter here, and that was when we had the ice storm and nobody wanted to go outside anyway, so I kind of gathered up all my notes and began writing a rather lengthy narrative based on that, and I called it Mockingbird Hill. That's the third piece of thing I'll pull out here today. That was the name I gave my grandfather's place when I was 6 years old, and I kept hearing this Patti Page song about it over the radio. Well, using Rick Manson's term, in Mockingbird Hill, I was writing almost entirely about the life that chose me. I was placed in a certain setting, and I just lived it. Fortunately, it was a safe and loving setting, even with its precarious economic conditions, which I did not even see until many years later. As I've come to learn over the course of my life, not everyone has a life chosen for them in as fortunate a way as was mine, even with its hardships. Well, near the end of this still unfinished story, and I don't know, maybe I'll get to the rest of it, and maybe I won't. I guess it depends upon how much longer my life is still that interesting to me as I decide to go along with it. But when I got to the end of it, I jumped ahead to the end of my college days. And to describe one of those moments when the life that chose us also jumps into the life that we choose. As I said, I jumped ahead to my college years, and I focused on a moment that came back to me almost four years ago, when I saw the movie We Are Marshall. The movie takes place, it was largely filmed on the campus of Marshall University and in the town of Huntington, West Virginia. Marshall is the school I attended and from which I graduated in 1967. And this film tells the story of how the university and that small city of Huntington, how they both pulled themselves back together following a plane crash in November of 1970 that killed the entire Marshall football team, coaching staff, and many of the local team boosters as they were returning from an away game in North Carolina. A few players and a coach who were not on board were the only survivors. By then, I'd already graduated, but I knew one of the players who was on the plane, a guy I'd grown up with in my hometown. Well, in this film, the central character is played by Matthew McConaughey, and he plays the coach who was brought in to rebuild the team from scratch, Jack Langle. He didn't have too successful a time. He didn't have too much to work with, but in the intervening years after that, Marshall football program went on to build themselves into something of a real powerhouse, and one of their star players at that time, in the course of rebuilding that team, one of their star players was Randy Moss. I'm just going to leave that be. Given the attitude of Patriot Country right now. But back to the movie. There was a scene right near the end that kind of pushed me back in my seat with something of a G-force. It was shot in a park that runs along the Ohio River near the campus. And it takes place, the setting is about a year after the crash. It involves a young woman played by Kate Mara, who was engaged to one of the players on the plane. She's also an occasional voiceover narrative throughout the movie. In this particular scene, she's walking along with the man who would have been her father-in-law. The father, that is, of one of the players who was killed. That character is played by Ian McShane. He's also kind of a mover and shaker in the Huntington and Marshall communities. Ian McShane tells Kate Mara as they walk along the river that it's time for her to pick up and move on with her life, even as they still each bear the pain of their shared loss. His counsel to her is, if you don't leave now, you never will. And one of the last scenes in this movie shows Miss Mara driving away from Huntington in her Volkswagen. And the thing that knocked me out as I watched that scene was that even though my circumstances were a world apart from those of Kate Mara's character, I had walked through that same park and along that same river thinking similar thoughts at about that same time in my life. Here's how I wrote about it. If you don't leave now, you never will. I came to the same conclusion as my Marshall base approached their end. I even took a few walks myself along the Ohio River, wondering what my next move would be. I wasn't sure where my life was going at that point, but on some instinctive level, I knew I couldn't stay there. I did get myself a geographical destination in Rochester, New York, which at least gave me a place to go, even though I didn't know where it would lead. I wasn't angry about anything. I didn't feel like I was running away from Huntington or Mockingbird Hill. I just knew it was time to go. I also knew that if you don't leave now, you never will. And as I headed into the next phase of my life, I drove off in a Volkswagen. Every leave taken, as I've since come to learn, is also, in one sense or another, a homecoming, or is driven by a desire for a homecoming. That's yet another dynamic. That's another yin-yang of any narrative, along with what is chosen for you and what you chose. The other dynamic is when and from where did you have to leave? And what was the home you were seeking, consciously or not, when you took your leave? And that was the question on which I ended this particular portion of my own narrative. Moving on quickly now, the greater goal of any quest or search for one's life narrative is not just to recover or discover your own story, helpful and rewarding as that usually is. It's also about finding your place, finding your connections, finding your web of relationships in the greater context of your life. I reminded myself of this when I got down to concluding paragraphs of my own writing project by noting, our stories, unique as they may be to us, are never ours alone. They're always part of a greater narrative. Taken as far as it could go, that narrative could be extended to the entire human story itself, and even beyond that, to the life of this grand and mysterious universe in which we all live, move, and have our being. So on this note, I'm going to close where I opened. When Dr. Stern set out to tell her story, she was, at the outset, and so it appeared, doing so for intensely personal reasons. As her story went on, it became less and less about her and more about the people for whom she found herself writing. In her case, it was for people who had been deeply traumatized at one point in their life and who were still trying to face that experience and integrate it into a larger story of their life in a way that would allow them to know their whole story and find peace with it. Indeed, she concludes her second book by saying just that, that she wasn't writing for herself, but for others who had also had their lives shaped in some way or another by a trauma and who could not quite yet, as she put it, bear to admit those wounds exist. Well, not all. Probably not most personal narratives are told from such an intense angle. They're not told for exactly the same purpose as Dr. Stern's is. But the larger point, however, is that finding our stories are not, or they need not be, exercises in mere self-indulgence. Each of our narratives, whatever their content, are ones that can point us towards a greater understanding and some greater level of enlightenment about the mystery that we are connected. They are not exercises, then, in self-indulgence, but rather ones in self-awakening, an awakening to our place in the greater web of creation. And that's what our closing hymn is about. Wake now, my senses. It's number 298. Let's sing that together.